Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. City Council's Tariq Bakari leaves to take a job with the Trump administration, but not before sending texts to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings that the chief views as damaging to his reputation. He considers suing, but the council meets in closed-door session and decides to settle. That raises some eyebrows among some council members, including Tijuana Brown. Mr. Bakari recommends his wife fill out the remainder of his term on council, but Krista Bakari speaks out against the secret settlement reached with the chief, and that may have played into the mayor's tie-breaking vote, which led council to choose an old face to return to that body, Edwin Peacock. Then Tijuana Brown finds herself indicted by the Justice Department for wire fraud and wire fraud conspiracy in connection with COVID-19 relief funds. She denies the charges and refuses to resign her seat. And all of that in the course of less than 2 months. So just to make sure you're caught up, we're going to spend the hour doing just that. We're joined by Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. We have nothing to talk about this morning. Good morning. So, Steve, you've been covering local politics for a very long time. Have you ever witnessed this kind of a string of activity that is so uncharacteristic of what we normally think of as Charlotte government?
Probably, when you say string of activity, I think probably the answer is no. I mean, certainly when Mayor Patrick Cannon was arrested back in 2014, that was a huge news story. But the key words you said, string of activity, this is, I think this is pretty unprecedented. I don't know, Joe and Eric, if you guys can think of anything, but yeah, this is really unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about it in the lead up to this show, and I mentioned to Joe before we came on, for a one-day story, the Cannon arrest was an earthquake. But this series of events, I'm not sure when Charlotte became Game of Thrones, but I guess it was in the last 2 months, right? I mean, you don't fight City Hall. City Hall fights itself. This has been just bonkers.
So does this mark a change in the tenor of our politics, something that kind of is beginning to match the national political scene? Is it the result of growing pains, or is this just a convergence of coincidental, unrelated circumstances all converging at the same time? Joe?
Tough to say, because a lot of this stuff we wouldn't know about had it not been for reporting. So has this been going on for a longer period of time? I'm not sure. I think that this is big city stuff that we're dealing with here, big city controversies that other cities deal with annually. And I do think that the public's better off that all this is in the light.
But you said we wouldn't know about it had it not been for the media. There you go, blaming the media. So help me out with the Johnny Jennings timeline. Tariq Bakari told council he would resign to take a job with the Trump administration back in April. When did the texts that he sent to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings come to light, Joe, and how did they come to light?
They came to light because of Steve Harrison's record request. And I believe Steve can chime in more on this, but he got his records back in November. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Tariq Bakari sent the text messages to the chief in the summer of 2024 about this dispute over these outer carrier protective vests. And it was interesting. I mean, Mike, you've heard us all talk about problems with getting public records out of the city, something that continues. It was interesting in the Bakari situation, getting those records back actually became very quickly, because at the time, I think the city was willing to put these out because they were willing to cast Tariq Bakari in a really negative light. I don't think they had a problem with that. And so they produced them very quickly. Then at the time, nothing really happened. It was pretty quiet. And then months later, we come into April, and Joe reports that the city is in closed session voting to give the chief this financial settlement. So we had this long lag period. And then
so Joe wants to jump in here, but before I do that, you just mentioned that the city released these in part, perhaps because they showed Tarek in a bad light. Are you saying that city staff essentially undermined a council member?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, I guess what I'm saying is that the city responded to the records request appropriately as they're supposed to. But there are other instances when we all make records requests and the city staff is the one that is going to be put in a negative light. And I think they tend to slow walk those.
Joe.
Well, keep in mind during this time frame as well, while Steve is making this records request and waiting on the records to come back, we know that Major Brad Koch and Sandy Vastola, the chief's top spokesperson, are also working with Corinne Mack behind the scenes and advising her on how to file a records request. So there was all of this action going on behind the scenes that we didn't know about. And maybe that played a role into how Steve was able to get those records relatively quickly.
Eric.
And Mike, at risk of disrupting the timeline, you know, we had that subsequent press conference after Councilwoman Victoria Watlington raised allegations of corruption in the way that the settlement was conducted with Chief Jennings. But the thing that stands out to me, going back to Steve's reporting in November, is that he publishes the story, and then not only is there kind of public silence, but there's silence from the mayor, from the council, from the city manager. And you even heard the mayor during that press conference a couple of weeks ago, where she said that she apologized to Chief Jennings for not standing up sooner and defending him against some of the things that then Councilman Beccari had threatened him with. And I still think that is a really important part of this timeline of why the city did not respond initially when this went public.
So these texts from former Councilman Tarek Beccari to the police chief were over these protective vests. Beccari wanted the police to have these protective vests. I believe Chief Jennings was not in favor of that because he said it made them look too militaristic. And these texts from Tarek threatened to cripple the legacy of Chief Jennings, and he promised in those texts that he would work to get him fired. Steve, how out of the ordinary are communications like these between two city officials, one elected, one an employee, whether it's in the background or in person or on electronic devices? How unusual is this?
So, Mike, I'll say in theory, in Charlotte's former government, when council members have a problem, they're supposed to run everything through the manager. That's how it's supposed to work on paper. But it doesn't work that way, and I don't think people really expect it should. Elected officials do go straight to city staff members and talk about problems and lean on them for assistance to get things done, et cetera. Now, having said that, the tone of what Tarek Beccari wrote was pretty crazy. I mean, that was pretty unusual, the language, if I'm going to work to get you fired, cripple your legacy. That was highly unusual. I haven't seen anything like that. But then at the same time, there are a lot of elected officials who work for the city today and who worked at the city in the past who may not have been on the receiving end of that much vitriol, but who did receive a lot of grief from elected officials over their time. And they are a bit surprised after what they went through that the chief was able received the settlement for $305,000.
Joe, these were personal texts from one city council person to the police chief. And the reason we've come to this settlement, I guess, it was a preemptive strike to prevent the chief from suing the city for the content of these texts, which he found to be injurious. Except they were never supposed to be released to the public. I guess the media is responsible for that. So that made them injurious to his possible potential career. But these were between a councilman and an official. Why didn't he choose to sue Tarek? Why sue the city?
Well, the chief hasn't said why. I mean, one just reason thinking about this is the city is his employer. The city also has more money for damages in a potential lawsuit. And Paul's also part of his claims are, you know, it wasn't just a text message. It was, you know, the crusade to have me fired, the, you know, the push for the city manager to get involved. It was just all the whole surrounding debate that he viewed was inappropriate. In the settlement, he put that there were violations of state and federal law. The city wrote that up, that the chief claims that there were violations of state and federal law, I'm guessing around employment matters. But we don't know specifically which laws he thinks were violated.
So city council met in private session, actually two private sections, which we'll talk about. But the bottom line is that the suit was never brought because council met in that closed door session to see if they could reach a settlement. Was Jennings involved in either of those closed door meetings?
I don't have reporting on that. They were reporting back to his attorneys either way. So it depends on your definition of involved, I would say.
Have we ever received any answer as to why the city felt it necessary to preemptively pay Chief Jennings to settle a suit that had not even been filed?
I think that, not that I know of, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's one of the questions that will be pursued in the state auditor's investigation that was disclosed last week.
And I guess there are two theories that you could have. One is they would think it would be embarrassing if the world found out about this debate and a lawsuit was eventually filed. They would worried about the impact of that. I think another reason, potentially, maybe they view a risk of losing even more if this did get filed.
And I'll say, can I jump in real quick on that? I think it's interesting that, so Joe had reported back in a few weeks ago that, you know, he'd mentioned Corinne Mack of the NAACP had filed this ethics complaint against Tariq Bakari at the beginning of the year. At the time, the city dismissed that. And, you know, at the time, Bakari is a sitting council member. Following through with the ethics complaint was going to be a big hassle. I mean, that was going to be a lot of difficulty for the city. And so I think the path of least resistance at that time was to dismiss the complaint about the text messages. Then Bakari leaves, and then the chief comes forward with his complaints and potential lawsuit. And again, the path of least resistance is to settle. And I think that's just a big theme here. There's a problem presented to the city, and it's kind of like, what's the fastest way? Just what? How can we put this behind us as quickly as possible? And I think you saw that in both of those instances.
Eric.
Just a quick point of context I think that's important to remember is this settlement's $305,000. His salary's $280,000 a year. That's a big number in comparison to the salary that he receives. Yeah. For the Business Journal, we have to talk about money.
One of you mentioned, I've forgotten which one of you mentioned, that the Chief Jennings alleges that laws were broken, both federal and state laws, and that was reported in the Charlotte Optimist, which is a newsletter, which alleges that Jennings was offended not so much by the actual messages that call for his firing and persecution, essentially. They published the document saying that he alleged to the city that his rights were violated under the state and federal laws. Do we know which ones he's referring to?
No, we do not.
Okay. Is taking preemptive situations, actions like this in situations like this, a pattern, Steve, in the city? Just to get it, sweep it under the rug or get it done, let's move on. Is that a pattern? And is it a healthy pattern? 30 seconds.
I think you've seen that in the past, that again, let's push this behind us. Let's move forward. Let's, you know, and again, in the city, was hoping none of this would ever come to the light of day.
Yeah. But of course, it did, because of people like you, you bad guys. We have to take a break. We'll come back more, talk about this and other things that have been happening on council in and out of their control in the last several weeks. We'll do that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are talking about the unusual amount of unusual activity that's been going on at Charlotte City Council in the months of April and May, with three people who have covered it all: Steve Harrison, WFA's political reporter; Joe Bruno, a reporter for WSOC-TV; and Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Steve, you reported that there were actually two closed-door sessions at which this was discussed, this settlement for the chief. You reported that at the first meeting, one council member had to leave early and was counted as a yes vote in favor of paying Jennings. At the second meeting, one council member asked if they could change their vote from the previous week, and they were told no. Same council member or a different council member?
Different council members, but I will pass this question to Joe, who did most of the reporting on, okay, who broke the story on those closed sessions. But yes, I think that's generally correct.
Yeah, so that first meeting, they had five people who voted to settle. The vote looked like it failed because it takes six, no matter how many people are in a room, to pass something. But the city attorney and the city manager went back and researched and determined that it actually had passed with six votes because a council member left early and was not excused from the meeting. And that vote was recorded as a yes vote. The next meeting was when they informed council that, hey, this passed last week. One council member spoke up and said, hey, I would like to change my vote. Can we revisit it? And that council member was told you would need a supermajority of members to revisit the vote because it has already passed.
So in the aftermath of that decision, when we learned about that decision, we had the mayor on this program, and I asked her about the amount of money involved in the settlement, which at the time was rumored to be between $100,000 and $300,000. She said she couldn't speak to it because that's a personnel matter. The city attorney backed her up. But this month, the state auditor launched an investigation to find out the amount, saying that even if it was one penny, quote, it should be disclosed to the public in a timely and transparent manner. There is no tax dollar free from public scrutiny. We have two sets of opinions here. Where does the law come down on that?
I find it really interesting the way the city structured this settlement. And I think more reporting needs to be done on this because, you know, in the past, the city has had press conferences releasing settlement figures. They have released settlement figures openly in the past. And then there was all this secrecy around this one. I don't know if it has to do with the fact that the settlement itself was in a separation agreement, which was in a personnel file. So it was a settlement, but it was structured in a way that it was a separation agreement. So it was hidden in this personnel file that is confidential between the employee and the employer.
Steve. Yeah, I was going to... The word Joe used, he said kind of hidden inside. I think that's really important because state law is a little ambiguous about what can and can't be released. There is a statute that says any settlement has to be public. And when you read that document, while the city said this isn't a settlement, the word settlement is clearly in the agreement with Chief Jennings. That's one thing. State law also says that any contract between the employer and an employee about the terms of their employment must be made public. And if you read the agreement very carefully, it talks about retroactive pay increase. It talks about a retention bonus for the next 7 months moving forward, extra vacation time. Clearly, those are terms for the chief's continuing employment. So this agreement was really kind of a grab bag of different payments. And I think you can make a strong argument that that this should have been released before the state auditor forced the city's hand.
Eric.
It jumps out to me, as I'm sure it probably does to our fellow panelists, that not only has the interim city attorney gone back and forth on what can be disclosed and what can't, but the mere existence of an interim city attorney, because the previous city attorney was ousted by city council under another set of controversial circumstances that raised questions about transparency. So I just would throw that in there.
They haven't. They have not yet disclosed why they chose not to continue with the previous attorney. They haven't. I don't think they've disclosed the amount of money that they settled with him, but it's probably in the several hundred. It's six figures or more. We have come to learn the exact figure of the Johnny Jennings settlement. It was neither $100,000 nor $300,000. It was $305,000, and it was disclosed by Chief Jennings himself. Had he not disclosed it, Eric, would we still be in the dark?
I think we would. I think we would be waiting for the pressure of the state auditor's investigation to eventually make this public and concrete. Going back to what Joe was saying, I don't know that there ultimately would be any way to get out of disclosing this publicly, but the city likely would have dragged their feet.
So he disclosed this. Chief Jennings disclosed the amount as he announced plans to retire from the force at the end of the year, or at least the end of January of next year. And if I recall correctly, one of the bases for his considering bringing a suit against the city was because he said that Tariq Bakari's comments would both tarnish his professional reputation and impede his ability to find another job in law enforcement. But now he has this settlement and he's retiring. Put that together for me, Eric.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to ask that same question. You know, it's an easy thing to look at and say, well, wait a minute, you're retiring, so how is this hurting your future job prospects? And we have not mentioned yet that the Charlotte Fraternal Order of Police is, as we speak, conducting a no-confidence vote against the chief that will wrap up next week, and that is unprecedented, at least in Charlotte. So there are so many angles and aspects to this story. It is not one of those where you simply point and say, I think this person was right and this one was wrong. There's a lot of gray all around.
I think that the chief, him retiring, clearly retiring from the city of Charlotte, but I'm not sure we can use the word retirement kind of blanketly for the rest of his life. Like, he could very easily go to the private sector, nonprofits, whatever. I think there's probably, he may still be working. And I think his feeling was, the argument in those closed sessions was that all this controversy had damaged those prospects for him moving forward.
We now have the document, the actual document that outlines all of the agreement between the city and Chief Jennings. It's called the General Waiver Release and Separation Agreement. So before we talk about dollars and cents, his retirement from the force is scheduled for January 31st, 2026. It's outlined in that agreement. Why is that part of the settlement? Did he decide he could no longer work for the city, or did they decide he could no longer work for us? Anybody know?
The impression I get is that the chief, he's been there 33 years. He's given, over three decades of service, that he wanted to retire. He wanted to, he was done. He's been chief, how many years? I mean, he came
five
during
years.
COVID.
Five years.
It's a long time to be chief. So I think that this was on his horizon regardless. And this just, I guess, in a way codifies it. And in the chief's view, rights the wrongs that he felt that had been put upon him.
So in the agreement, they used the term severance in regard to a portion of the $305,000. If he is retiring, why are they using the term severance? That's usually given to people who are let go.
I think that's another question that can only be answered by the people who crafted the agreement.
Okay. So much of this, Mike, goes into, and I think you posed the question earlier, is like, How did they get to the number 305,000? Why is it that number, and why is it structured this way? Steve was talking about some of the particulars. Is it for tax purposes? Is it because of other legal issues that we don't know? There are a lot of things that are still to be answered here that we just simply don't know.
Yeah, this agreement cobbles together funds from very different buckets. He receives a retroactive pay raise from the first of this year until December 31st, amounting to a little over $14,000. He receives a bonus in excess of $45,000, plus an additional 40 days of vacation, wouldn't that be nice, valued in excess of $45,000, and it outlines severance pay in the amount of $175,000 to be paid by the end of next January, and $25,000 for costs incurred because of the dispute. I'm assuming that Chief hired an attorney. Do we understand how or why? You just said we don't understand how or why they came to these figures. We just don't know.
We don't know. But it, I mean, when you read that off, it does sound like kind of a grab bag of ways to get to, you know, we don't know this again, but did they start with a number and say, okay, how do we get to this number? How do we find various ways and various funds to do this? I'm going to be, as will the rest of the panel, be very interested to see how this was determined.
Will we ever know?
I hope so, Mike. I really do. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of records that are still going to be out there. All of them are running for re-election, so all of them are going to be doing tons of media. I think that the city manager also is in the spotlight here for not being in the spotlight. I think there are a lot of people who have to answer questions about this.
And my impression or my understanding is that when they went into closed session and they kind of talked about, we feel like we need to move forward with the settlement, et cetera. They gave council members a dollar figure, but the kind of that detailed breakdown that we've been talking about, vacation pay, retention bonus, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding is that council did not get a really detailed breakdown at that point, you know, because I think maybe there would have been some more questions of like, well, wait, why are we doing a retention bonus? What are the implications on taxes and pension and things like that? And I don't, my understanding is they didn't go that granular.
So, Joe, Eric mentioned that there is this vote going on within the Fraternal Order of Police, a no-confidence vote in the chief. Is it connected to this? Why is this happening?
Yes.
Is morale, okay, morale is low? Is there truly a lack of confidence in the chief? And if so, why? Is it over these vests and the fact that he didn't want them and a city councilman did?
I think this vote was spurred because of all these closed door negotiations between the city and the police chief. It's about the vest. It's also about the department currently with the morale in the department, just general overall leadership of the chief in the FOP's view. So the FOP is voting right now. It's an online ballot. I don't have a timeline. They have said, though, that they will do a press conference to announce the results.
I think they're voting through June 3rd, which is that next Tuesday. I hope I have my calendar right.
At one point in the middle of these maneuvers, Councilmember Victoria Watlington sent an email to her constituents in which she said she was, quote, extremely concerned with the level of unethical, immoral, and frankly illegal activities occurring within city government. Those are her words. And she said that the way the city handled the settlement demonstrated, quote, a brazen disregard for dissenting opinions and the rule of law. The mayor has pushed back on that. What has happened as a result of those allegations, Steve?
Well, initially, in the day after, or the same day as Councilmember Watlington's email, that was a couple of weeks ago when the city had that big press conference in the chamber of the government center when, you know, the mayor and other council members said there is, you know, if Councilmember Watlington has proof of corruption, she needs to come forward, et cetera. I think Victoria Watlington was trying to bring up using inflammatory language and over the top language, but her sense was that the city has a process by which the cake is always baked on issue after issue, and that when things come to them, there are already six votes lined up, staff is already lined up, and there's really no room to make changes and to be heard, et cetera. Now you could argue, look, that's politics, that's numbers, that's the way things go. But I think that her frustration over that kind of boiled over in this instance.
Joe.
Kind of going back to Game of Thrones. I can't remember if we were talking about that at the beginning of the show or before the show, but there is an impression that the mayor and the manager can team up and get whatever they want done, done. And they can find five people or six people to fall in line with them and just kind of ram through whatever their priority is. Whether you think that's true or not, that's up for you to decide. But that is an impression that people in and outside of city council have.
Eric.
And I was going to say, and you guys know this too, a lot of times council members who mostly vote with what the mayor and manager are in favor of, they will privately tell you that they are frustrated by the way information is not fully revealed or revealed at the last minute. This has been an ongoing theme as Vilas has been mayor. And, you know, to Steve's point, you could look at it both ways. You could say, hey, look, that's politics. That's the smart way to do it. And you can also look at, you know, some of the dissension and dysfunction that we have.
Successful House and Senate leaders in Washington, successful House and Senate leaders in the General Assembly, successful presidents do it this way. They get the votes before they have the vote, so they're not embarrassed by the vote. And that's kind of how it works. But these charges are more than that. These are charges of unethical, immoral, and illegal activities. Will we get to the bottom of that? Because that's a pretty serious set of allegations.
Well, she backed away from those comments, Councilwoman Watlington did, and the council members and the mayor pretty forcefully rebutted that language. Nothing has come out reflecting any kind of corruption, law-breaking in that sense, and I'll let Joe pick it up from there.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, within 24 hours of that email, six council members and the mayor all had a press conference denouncing any possibility that a council member would be involved with illegal activity or corruption. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, a council member is charged with COVID-19 relief fraud, and all of council is silent on the issue, except for Malcolm Graham. He sent me a statement. So, you know, some people are also looking at this like, you guys are having this whole press conference talking and criticizing Victoria Watlington, accusing her of putting a bad light on the city, saying those words, you know, cast a dark shadow on Queen City. And then this happens and you guys are silent.
So we're going to go on to Tijuana Brown in just a second, but I want to, I have 30 seconds. What will Chief Jennings was intending to retire earlier than he will. He decided to stay because of some things the police were going through. What will his legacy be? You cover the police beat, Joe. What will his legacy be? I have 20 seconds.
He showed fantastic leadership after the officers were shot and killed on Galway Drive. The day-to-day tasks and the other tasks that he has to do on the administrative side is certainly a mixed bag.
Joe Bruno's with WSOC-TV, Eric Spanberg with The Business Journal, and Steve Harrison with WFAE News. We will continue right after this. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We've just spent 35 minutes talking about the police chief and the settlement between him and city council for texts sent to him that he felt were damaging to his reputation from Tariq Bakari. We talked about it because it's so unusual for Charlotte. And just when you think it's safe to come back into the water, the Department of Justice throws us another curve on council. Last week, they handed down an indictment against Councilwoman Tijuana Brown and her two daughters for wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Russ Ferguson is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina.
She attached IRS forms that were not real and not actually submitted to the IRS, made false statements on the applications, and got taxpayer money in return.
Those are the allegations by the Department of Justice, but as Mr. Ferguson pointed out on this program, in America, you are innocent until proven guilty, but the DOJ doesn't generally bring charges they don't believe they can't successfully prosecute. Eric, what has Tijuana Brown had to say about this?
She has been steadfast throughout this that she's going to fight it, that she has not... done anything wrong. She says she has repaid, I think, roughly $21,000. She says she will run for re-election. And she also says that justice doesn't always love people who look like me. So she has been pretty clear that she is going to fight this and that she expects to win, and she has pled not guilty.
We're going to talk about all of those things you just pointed out. The indictment says that she submitted false statements to obtain forgiveness of PPP loans. Those are loans that were made available during the pandemic to employers who wanted to keep their employees' payroll checks coming. And the DOJ says that she falsely obtained at least $124,165 in connection with what they call a scheme to defraud, their words. Steve, what do they say she spent that money on?
The only specific instance in the indictment they give is that they say that Tijuana Brown received a loan for just under $21,000. I believe this was in 2021. The money was deposited to the bank account, they say, of her nonprofit, Beauty After the Bars. Then the indictment alleges that really a month later, Tijuana Brown, she wasn't a council member yet, throws an elaborate birthday party for herself that cost at least $15,000, the horse-drawn carriage, a rented throne, rose petal walls, a really extravagant event. And so that, I believe, was the one instance they did talk about how the money was spent.
How do they know that? I mean, we have video of the party, so we know that the party was held, but how do we know the money for the party came from those funds? How does the Department of Justice know, Joe?
The money that she received from the feds for COVID-19 relief payroll was deposited into the Beauty After the Bars bank account, which was then used for that birthday party.
Okay. So these PPP loans were created to help employers meet payroll at a time when little to no income was coming into a lot of businesses because of pandemic shutdowns. She says that she applied for the loan because she was, quote, starting a new business. Eric, does that incriminate her? I mean, that's not what these loans are for.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I honestly had not thought about that aspect. Joe?
That was a key question I kept asking, like, why did you apply for these funds? On the application that was accepted for the money, it went to TC Collection, which was, I guess, her swimwear company, and she had claimed that it was already profitable, like they had made $96,000 or something in 2019, and that they had 11 employees. It's not a registered business with the Secretary of State. They only have a minimal social media imprint as well. I couldn't find a website, so I'm not sure exactly what this business is. But I kept asking, like, why did you apply for the funds? And we never got a clear answer. We heard that she was starting up the business. She wouldn't tell me that she was using those funds for payroll. It's unclear if she has 11 employees, who these 11 employees are. So those are, I think, a lot of the things that the feds are looking at as well.
She has also said that when she discovered that there was some scrutiny surrounding her application for and use of these funds, that she paid back the portion of the loan that she was responsible for, which amounts to $20,833. What do we know about that? Does paying back the loan make a difference if you knowingly received it or applied for it through fraudulent applications?
You know, that's a great question. Sometimes the government reaches settlements with people for matters like this. However, it was more than just the fact that she received $20,000. The feds say she and her two daughters sent in like 15 different applications using fake IRS forms and fake documentation to try to obtain more. In total, they all obtained about $120,000.
And Russ Ferguson, the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, did say that both the courts and the Department of Justice take into consideration people who do this deliberately versus people who do it out of ignorance, that if they discover they really didn't know what they were doing, the sentence is sometimes more lenient or they reach a settlement. She says, Steve, that she is innocent. She pleaded not guilty at the hearing recently. Is that what the DOJ will have to prove, that she knew she was being fraudulent, or could she simply have not been familiar with the terms of these loans? When she became aware of them, she paid the money back. Is that indicative of the fact that she was trying to be honest?
I think in the news conference on Thursday morning that she held, Joe, help me, I think I've got this right, that she was kind of laying the groundwork. Her defense, the argument was, I think she said, oh, a third party did the applications, and my mistake was trusting them to handle it correctly. Now, presumably it's going to be her signature on the documents, on the loans and the Schedule C tax forms, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know how far that's going to go. But Mike, to your earlier point, I think that it's kind of a double whammy here. I think there are other people who have misused COVID relief money that they probably got legitimately from a legitimate business. This is kind of a double whammy where the allegation is that the businesses didn't even exist. They weren't entitled to the money. And then once the money came in, this really troubling allegation that $15,000 was spent on a birthday party. So it's kind of coming and going.
She says she's not resigning. She is giving voters what they voted for and that she intends to run for re-election. And last night she held a town hall meeting that you reported on this morning, Steve, that was scheduled prior to her indictment. It was an open-ended town hall meeting, but constituents didn't seem to want to talk about this.
Yeah, it was the town hall is mostly presentations by city staff about things like traffic and crime and things like that. And then there is a Q&A. It was about half an hour where people from Steel Creek got up to the mic and asked, and they all talked about these things. I think a lot of people in the audience were thinking about the indictment, but it would take a lot of guts to get up and kind of question a council member like that. No one did. Now, at the end of the meeting, Councilmember Brown, she did address it. She didn't totally ignore it. She talked about how the last 6 days have been some of the toughest of her life. And then she kind of reiterated this position that she is not quitting and she's going to continue to fight.
When these charges, as Eric mentioned, Joe, when these charges were announced, she played the race card by saying, quote, justice doesn't always love people that look like me. Does this case have anything to do with race?
Not that I've seen. The investigation was actually initiated by the former U.S. Attorney Dena King, who was appointed by Joe Biden and is a Black woman as well. So I think that, you know, maybe that will be a defense of hers. We'll see. But certainly nothing that I've seen so far has shown concrete proof of that.
She's also said she will never speak to the media again because the media ruined her reputation. Aside from politicians always blaming the media for their woes, which is becoming a very tired trope, what have we, the media, done to tarnish her reputation? Besides report the facts.
For you there. No, we're just reporting the facts. She hasn't told me that. She's never speaking to the media again. She's talked to me in the past week.
She spoke to the media last night, as a matter of fact.
Right, right. Yeah. So I don't think that will hold true. She also is running for re-election, so she's going to have to speak to the media at some point. It will be an interesting re-election campaign, though, because if you are convicted of a felony, you have to resign your seat. You're no longer qualified for it, or city council has to remove you from the seat. So she will be running, and she may win re-election, but voters have to weigh, like, will this person be my elected representative if she is convicted in a couple
months? Is that a city regulation? Is it a state law? Because we have a convicted felon sitting in the White House 34 times.
State constitution. And I believe somebody tried to sue in North Carolina about that with President Trump. But for whatever reason, President Trump wasn't bound by this provision of the state constitution.
So this all cycles back now to Tariq Bakari, of course. He's the Republican who left the council to go to Washington to work in the Trump administration in the Department of Transportation. And council had to pick his replacement. It had to be a Republican because he was a Republican. And they chose former member of council Edwin Peacock. Steve, why?
This was a really interesting night because the vote was 5-5. Five people voted for Edwin Peacock, who's a very traditional Republican, has served on the council before. His father served on the council. And then the other candidate that got five votes was Krista Bakari, Tarek Bakari's wife. Many of her votes came from that kind of opposition wing on the council, people who are kind of frustrated with the status quo. And then it was interesting. So you have a 5-5 tie. I think they were really hoping not to have that. The mayor had to break the tie, and the mayor, in explaining how she broke the tie in voting for Peacock, said in her statement that she was doing what she felt was the will of the council.
Yeah, let's hear exactly what she said following the vote.
I have listened to many of us talking what the opportunities are, and in this case, I believe that the council supported Edwin Peacock as the next District 6 representative. And so with that, that is my vote.
So it's a 5-5 split. How did she reach that conclusion? Is this another example of what we were talking about earlier, where the mayor and perhaps the city manager get together and they decide where they want council to go?
Well, I don't know if the mayor and the city manager got together, but look, the mayor has had her issues with former Councilman Bakari. He certainly was not popular with some of his colleagues on his way out the door. And the thing that really struck me is that Krista Bakari had support from Congressman Tim Moore, from House Speaker Destin Hall, from State Senator Vicky Sawyer. And the Republican Party was upset about the tie-breaking vote. And because I can't help myself, I have to think about transit. And when you have this issue before the legislature in Raleigh, you just wonder, could that frustration lead to problems with the transit piece?
Well,
so there's a lot of
that was part. That was part of Krista Bakari's pitch to council as she made her case for getting the job.
With a potential tax referendum coming in November, you'll want someone in this seat who can build trust and navigate conversations with both this council and the General Assembly.
So, Edwin Peacock, longtime Republican, conservative Republican, traditional Republican, whose father was also in the same mold, does he have the kind of connections and relationships with people in Raleigh that perhaps Tarek Bakari's wife Krista would have had because of Tarek to get this council or to get this General Assembly vote that allows us to put a tax for transit referendum on the ballot in November? Can he do it? Will he do it?
Well, to be fair to Edwin, it's not up to one council member. It's more the idea of would Raleigh Republicans and Charlotte Democrats be at odds, and could that cause problems? The machinery has already been in place and at work to get these bills passed and get that referendum going. But to Steve's point, Edwin Peacock is very much a moderate Republican. He's very much a traditional Charlotte politician. You know, before we had as many sort of big city controversies and fights and open disputes. So I think that the mayor and others who supported him were looking for a calming influence when they supported him.
I was going to ask, is this a way to bring council back to doing business the quote Charlotte way, unquote, which is what we've talked about for years. We don't ruffle feathers. Things just happen.
Yeah, I definitely think that. And as we were getting ready for this show, one of the things I thought about is if you look back over the years, this has not held up more recently. But Charlotte traditionally had a lot of business affiliated politicians and mayors. Pat McCrory, Anthony Fox was a corporate attorney, John Lasseter, council members like Greg Phipps came out of financial services. We don't see that as much anymore. And there is a certain segment of the population, the business community, I should say, who somewhat lament that, but they're not as willing to get involved as they once were.
He'll only be in office till the end of the year because that was the remainder of the term. There's a council election in November. What has he said about pursuing the District 6 seat going forward? Because he was the last Republican to hold an at-large seat on council.
Right. And he has said he is not going to run at large or run for this seat in the fall.
Can we assume that Krista Bakari will?
I think she hasn't said so, but I think she would be a favorite for the seat if she decides to.
So has counsel simply delayed the inevitable?
I think that the District 6 seat will be very competitive like it was last year. So Krista Bakari is going to, if she runs, she's going to be a great candidate. But I think that Democrats are going to go hard at the seat.
So I'm going to leave you with a question I know you can't answer and won't answer. Is this the end for city council drama for 2025, or are members of council all competing to be on that new reality TV show, The Real City Council Members of Charlotte, North Carolina? Is that what's happening here? Steve Harrison's a political reporter for WFAE News, Joe Bruno for WSOC-TV, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.